and welcome to Executive Perspective, Behind the Business. In this podcast, we bring you insights and perspectives from government leaders and executives around the Beltway and beyond.
I'm your host, J.D. Kathuria. Today, we sit down with author, thinker, and healthcare expert, Dan Pollino, who spent a year following Dr. Paul Grundy, the godfather of the patient-centered medical home movement, and talking with healthcare visionaries to do a deep dive into the evolution of healthcare. These interviews culminated into a book titled Trusted Healers, which explores healthcare leadership, accessibility, and proper patient care. Dan is here today with his wife, Ann Altman, to share more about the book. Welcome.
Thanks. Delighted to be
Thanks,
here.
Thanks, Teddy.
Dan, you spent 36 years at IBM and led the global healthcare and life sciences business for a decade. Your colleague there was Dr. Grundy, the chief medical officer for IBM's healthcare and life sciences industry. Can you tell us how you decided to focus on him in the book?
Paul's an amazing individual. Every once in a while in our life, you run into somebody that really makes a difference. He's the son of Quakers. He was born in South Africa, and he worked with leaders from Nelson Mandela to four sitting presidents. He was part of the State Department. And he saw a vision for better care, and that was around the continuum of care, and that everyone should have a relationship with their primary care doctor, and we would start to see this seamless integrated care model that produced far better results for individuals that were part of a system than anything we had seen before. And when I first started following Paul and going with him, it wasn't long, JD, before I said, Paul, you're going to be on the face of Mount Rushmore of healthcare. The way you approach it, the way it's patient-centered, the whole idea of the medical home, how you are as a visionary. And sure enough, he has been honored as the leader in this idea of the medical home, the patient-centered medical home. And it was Time Magazine, JD, that called him the godfather of the medical home. So it's not self-proclaimed. He has a lot of people that follow him, and it was my honor and pleasure to work with Paul over that period of time.
Yeah, so in the book, you went to journey his steps for a year in the U.S. and worldwide. So how was that experience?
Well, it was wonderful. It was actually a little longer than a year, as those things, you know, you start out and then you find yourself just captivated. We traveled the world on the idea that we could bring a better care model, an integrated care model. Of course, working with IBM, we like grand challenges, the whole idea about data integration. And really before Paul, the idea of integrated care was just starting to come alive. You see, what happened was, JD, people thought of insurance companies as financial institutions. People thought of pharma as distributors. And they thought of hospitals as, well, small, medium businesses, institutions that were scattered throughout geographies. The idea to bring all of the information and better care models into an integrated way, including prescription medications, including insurance of how it should be paid for, and then, of course, the provider organizations. And as you and I know, we've now seen insurance companies become integrated with care. We've seen pharma take a different path around trying to build the right kind of care models. And certainly the hospital systems now, where you integrate specialty care and primary care, are upon us. So it's kind of all come together with the patient in the middle. And that becomes the idea of a medical home where you have somebody that's available for you 7/24. You can reach out and have an appointment that day, and they have all of your information, all of your vitals, and they can help you. And that was at the center of this idea around patient-centered medical home.
Is there a regional area or country or area that the model works really well?
Yes, JD, there are areas around the world that do a better job than the U.S. does. And even within the U.S., we're starting to do a better job around medical homes. The most important fact here is that other countries spend more on primary care and on wellness than we do. We only spend 5-7% of our first dollar on care, where they spend 14-20%. And when you think about that, that's significant in the approach. We see that in Denmark, we see that in Sweden, we see that in Norway, we see that in countries that are ranked much higher than we are in the World Health Organization. Of course, as you know, we are ranked 37th in the world. We spend double what most countries do. Now, when I say this, JD, and people say, wait a second, we have the best care in the world. We really do have tremendous care. And it's almost always around specialty care. And we can do a far better job of integrating care up front. This whole idea of specialty care started in 1911. We had something called the Flexner Report, where we went into medical schools and said, this is how we should teach medicine. And it was around the idea of biosciences, medical education, and then go out and practice, sort of the residency. And with that, we created the best specialty in the world. We've been at that for over 100 years. But we did not spend the same amount of energy or money and commitment into primary care. And there was a reason for that. It's because many people thought the idea of primary care was either potentially with a doc, and in some cultures in the United States and others, it was an aunt. It was your grandmother. It was somebody else that would say to you, I know what that doctor said, but I'm going to put Vicks Vapor Rub all over you. I think that's the best thing to go do. And all of us have that experience where it's somebody in the family that really decided they would be that kind of trusted healer for a long time. What we've now learned, of course, is integrated care is better, and the ability to have a relationship with your primary care, that patient-centered medical home. And there's many spots in locations in the U.S. where people are doing a really good job of this. Many of the integrated delivery systems, you know, here locally, of course, KP, Inova, and others are doing a great job. And even when we start looking at what we do with the VA actually does a very good job around the idea and the concept of the medical home.
Yes, Anne.
Yeah, I just want to add that I think the conversation that Anne's created with the book Trusted Healers is one that people have been interested in or engaging on their own. And why isn't it that we focus on staying well? Why is it that in this country we tend to focus medicine on sick care? And this is a movement that is starting to gain a lot of momentum, and it gets back to the point of having a trusted healer, a medical home, where someone is caring for you to keep you well so that you don't need those specialists.
I agree. I know I saw something about someone talking about the impact of drunk driving, how no one thing solved that problem, that it started with education, awareness. How do you think education awareness is that one of the biggest challenges?
It certainly is one of the biggest challenge. And people talk about health education. For instance, it's very important to know your numbers, right? Blood pressure, cholesterol, glucose levels, your weight, stress, nicotine. Those six aspects in your life, if you have control over those, they make a significant difference. And then there's two other things that are very important: up to date on your vaccines, and then what we're talking about here. Do you have a relationship with a primary care doctor? Do you have an entry? And so when we start to get into education, it's important for people that are listening, people that read the book, to think about really three words: access. Do I have access to care? Engagement. Am I engaged with the doctor on these metrics that will help me live a better life? And then this idea about empowerment. This gets into our productivity, our contribution, how we think about what we do each and every day. And our health really does revolve, do I have access in the care? Am I engaged in the right way? And am I thinking about it the right way where I can take control of my life and make that contribution to my family, into society, and into the communities where we work and live.
In this book process, we talked a little bit more about the different interesting people and experiences you've had. Is there any story or experience that sticks out?
Well, thanks for bringing that up. So I want to tell you this story. So when I was a little kid, my mom and dad gave me this book. It was the 100 Greatest Sports Athletes of the Time. So I was reading about people like Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Athea Gibson and others that I'm sure our listeners are thinking of right now that they grew up with, that they remember. I had this book where every page was a page dedicated to that particular athlete. And I would go to bed every night and I would read the stories of these great athletes. So, Jade, we thought when we wrote this book, I wanted to do that for healthcare. I wanted to write an aspirational book where readers would then hear these stories about people that have done great things. And people would say, that's what kind of care I want to be a part of. And maybe that's the kind of career I want to have and be able to do that. There aren't too many aspirational books out there about healthcare. They're just not. We went out and talked to many of the leaders that I had worked with for many years. Dr. Michael Roizen from Cleveland Clinic, he's written 15 books, 4 bestsellers, just a tremendous leader around wellness. Dr. Glenn Steele and the work he's done at Geisinger, just amazing. We actually wrote about Nelson Mandela and the work that did with AIDS because Paul worked very closely with them as well. We interviewed, J.D., 42 people, and I was honored to have Patrick Kennedy do the foreword for us for the book. And I think everyone knows Congressman Kennedy and what he's done around mental and behavioral health. And I was, Ann and I were honored to have Patrick share with us his insights around mental and behavioral health and how important it is to have access into care. The book reflects, you know, a 10-year-old kid that would go to bed at night, and I had this book of 100 greatest athletes. And I thought, let's tell the story of what turns out to be, you know, 42 amazing people in healthcare. And we did that through the eyes and the work of Dr. Paul Grundy. And it was about leadership, about the leadership of these individuals and the contributions they've made and their level of aspiration to make a difference. And it was humbling. I was honored to do it. And I hope I brought their amazing work to life in the book.
And any interesting experiences in this book for you?
Oh, there were a lot. I mean, I was really behind the scenes, and oftentimes for Dan, I was reading the chapters and in silence and then coming back with my marked up copy. So, and we're still together after all of that. But, you know, one of the things that I love about the book is it's an easy book to read because it is, as Dan said, it's a story, it's stories of great people who had a vision of impact in society, whether it was here or around the globe. And it was that so inspired us about having this book out there, not just for people who are interested in healthcare as a conversation, but for people who have an interest in what it looks like to be a leader, to drive an agenda, to, you know, as we say with Paul, you know, to be the guy who drove the crusade for the medical home. And I think we accomplished it. We hope we did, and we hope the readers agree.
Yeah, we were thrilled when the book came out in September. We were surprised to learn that it was the number one new health policy book in healthcare. And we were thrilled with the acceptance and the number of people that wanted us to come talk to them and have a conversation. Of course, people like Dr. Grundy and Dr. Roizen and Dr. Steele and many others that are in the book, Dr. James Kingsland from England, Jeremy Hunt, who many people know was second to Boris Johnson to be the prime minister in England, is in the book. We have amazing stories of these leaders that have done things. Little Isle of Jersey, what they did was something called Call and Check. So it has everything from very small countries to very large countries to people that, like Nelson Mandela, to the change in AIDS, to literally creating programs to help the elderly ensure that they're up to date on their prescriptions and they don't trip on rugs and there's not an abusive situation. So as Ann says, there's a little something for everyone in the book, I think.
Many times large companies will have wellness programs. Have you seen companies use the book either at a book signing event or some other way to incorporate that into their overall HR plan?
It's amazing how much emphasis on wellness now. Now, I think that's because of culture, and the truth of the matter is we're short on workforce, so we need more people and we need more productivity, and people are paying attention now to healthcare in kind of a different way, that cultural aspect, especially mental and behavioral health and stress. And so we do get invited quite a bit. to come in and have that conversation about wellness and bring people like Dr. Roizen with us and get into stress management and how that should be handled differently. And that's coming from the top. And it's not just the CEOs and the presidents, but also the boards that manage those organizations now want to create a culture of wellness and a culture where people can be the best that they can be. And we've seen that in the last couple of years with tremendous momentum around wellness and getting in front of sick care and being able to offer these kind of programs.
And we talked a little bit before about the stigma and opioid crisis and how that started. And we didn't get into it in great detail. If you maybe share that story.
Yeah. So, you know, the opioid crisis is upon us. Last data, 2017, 90,000 people died from opioids. JD, it turns out that 70,000 of the people were not even under the care of a doctor. And so that tells us that it's a runaway problem that we don't have control over. It actually started in the late 90s. And the reason it started in the late 90s is because the pharma companies were able to develop these types of drugs to help us with pain management. And really, there was almost two kinds of pain management. There was a kind of pain management from maybe an injury, surgery, et cetera. But then there were other ways that people used those drugs, and they started to change the way they thought. And it wasn't necessarily around pain, but it was more around trying to do something with their life that they felt they needed and the drugs would help. Well, in the 90s, the idea was do no harm. And so if these drugs help because they weren't thought to be addictive, they were being prescribed 30, 60, 90 days, et cetera, not 7 days, not 5 days, not 3 days. Unfortunately, many people became addicted. And when they cut them off from OxyContin and the types of prescripted medication, they went out and got heroin. And so we saw a huge rise in the early 2000s around heroin. And then we started to get that under control. And then all of a sudden, another drug came up, fentanyl. And fentanyl, literally, if I put in your hand an uncoated aspirin and then took it away, the coating that's left on your hand, the white powder that's left from that aspirin that's not coated, is enough that could kill you. And a lot of that fentanyl comes from China and other places. They call it China Doll and Murder 8. This stuff is awful. And we're losing close to 200 people a day based on the opioid challenge that we have. And all it does is take one person in a family, and the entire family and the extended family is definitely impacted and affected by it. So we came upon this, started in the 90s, went in the early 2000s with heroin. We now have this runaway problem with fentanyl. In the book, I talk about how it takes 40 years to really understand some of these issues. 40 is an important number. We're maybe 30 years into this. And as I say that to you about 40 years, I want to just say this to the listeners. What do you think about vaping? Where are we on vaping? What have we learned from some of these drugs that people have taken? We're just in the early stages of this 40 years. And I think we should learn that when we start to see signs when people are dying from vaping, that action should be taken appropriately. And maybe we can learn from what's happened before with this opioid challenge and try and drive a different type of solution into some of these areas where people are vaping today because maybe nicotine or whatever, but we can do more. And so in the book, we talk about some of these things, about how long it takes to make a change. We use real life examples about how long it takes to do certain things. I'll give you a couple others that are really interesting. Martin Luther King was shot in 1968. Barack Obama was elected in 2008. In 1928, we had the first movie on air travel called Wings. 40 years later, we put a man on the moon. You can start to see things that have happened in society around change. How long does it take for something to change? And that brings us to Medicare and Medicaid. Lyndon Baines Johnson, 1965. this is why people really don't want to rip and replace and take those kind of things out. They've become such an important part of their life. Just recently, a lot of conversations about conditions and pre-existing conditions. And now it seems like everyone supports pre-existing conditions. And it wasn't so long ago that that was heavily debated everywhere. So we can learn as a society that sometimes it takes time to go through these things. But if we just pay attention, maybe we could change a life, help a family, and in some situations, through this idea of opioids, how did we get here? No shame, no blame. Check up from the neck up. Know your rights. Maybe, just maybe, we save someone's life.
What impact do you think social media has in the future of healthcare?
Well, social media is going to have a huge effect for a lot of reasons. People use social media today just to share their experiences. So probably not unlike many that live in a community. Ann and I have an app on the phone for Nextdoor. So it's an app where you share information in a predetermined area. And someone posted, I need a primary care doctor. Of course, I responded. And I said, you should be in a medical home. And here's one of the family practices that practices a medical home. And I got a really nice note back. So there's just an example on social media where people are going to look for experiences. And they're going to reach out with an app that's like next door, where you're asking for a plumber or you're asking for a babysitter or you lost your dog. Here we are sharing healthcare information. And that's just one example of many. Of course, it can be a different way. And this is one that concerns us all when kids might go to school or they get off on their own, or maybe they're sharing ideas about how cool it is to be vaping, or it could be the doing some things like that. And then, unfortunately, that influences a behavior that we're not hopeful for. So I think it's something that we have to pay very close attention to. I think it has some tremendous benefits, but we can't turn a blind eye to some of the things that might cause some problems for us too.
What do you think the biggest misconception is on a medical home?
Well, first of all, when I say medical home, many people think it's something for their house, for their home. Some people think that it's for the elderly, that it's a traditional kind of assisted living home. They don't understand it's meant to be the continuum of home, a place where your information is contained, where you can reach out and get the right kind of care. There was a lot of discussion about what the name of the patient-centered medical home should be. People were afraid that it would cause different meanings to different people. But the people that care about this and have really taken care of it, like Dr. Grundy, believe that the idea of the patient-centered medical home, where the patient is centered into a medical environment that's like a home where everything is contained for the continuum of care, won at the end of the day as the definition, and now it's around the world. People recognize what a patient-centered medical home is. Of course, along the way, if you built one of those and practiced in a medical home, then there was financial incentives to try and manage a cohort or catch them with people, a group of people, and manage them to wellness, not sick care. And that's what we're all about with this conversation, is trying to do well care, not sick care.
And who do you think should be, a lot of people should read the book, but who are the most important people, stakeholders should read this?
I guess I'd say there's a couple big ones. Certainly anybody who's interested in the conversation about healthcare and this big debate, certainly in our country, that's a pretty wide audience who says, just help me get more familiar with what this debate is about to inform me on the positions. Without this book declaring a political position, this is sharing an understanding of what it means to have a health system that focuses on wellness. So that's one. Two, and Dan brought this up, it's really around leadership. People who have an aspiration to create impact in their jobs, in their families, in their communities. Here are some wonderful examples, stories of people who have had that level of impact through different styles, different leadership styles, and different ways of delivering that.
And we talked, this is your first time as an author, so how's that experience been for you?
Yeah, first time author. Holy cow. You know, I have two stories. The first one is with Ann's dad, and he's a journalist. He's just doing great. He's 95 years old, you know, and he interviewed, three, four sitting presidents, and ran and reported for just about every major newspaper here in town. So I asked him to take a look at it, you know, and give me his trained eye. And so the first thing he says to me, he says, "Has this thing ever seen a copy editor?" So that was the first thing. And then Dr. Roizen, Mike Roizen, who's just spectacular at writing books, you know, four or five bestsellers in the New York Times. You know, he wrote Real Age, which is one of the best books on the idea of wellness that's out there, ever been done. And he's a good friend. And he said, "Look, I'll help you with this, being your first time, et cetera." So he says, "As soon as you've got your first manuscript, send it to me. I'll read it and I'll get back to you." So Bud Ramey and myself, Bud being the co-author, we send them the manuscript to Dr. Roizen. Ann and I happened to be down at the Kennedy Center for a performance, and across, you know, my phone comes a note from Mike. And I said, "Here it is." You know, he's read it. So let me tell you, it's the first manuscript, right? It's the first time. So we're sitting down, and I open up the note, and it says, "I hope you're sitting down. I want you to open a bottle of red wine, and I want you to know that I love you." That's the opening of his note. The next paragraph says, "And now you need to start over." Yeah, and he told me, he said, "You know, you're going to write this thing, you know, between 15 and 20 times. And you need to tell more stories. You need to bring some laughable parts to it. You need to have some serious parts to it. It needs more tone and tenor in the book." And I was more than thrilled. Mike was there with the launch. He's been a good friend. And, you know, he co-founded The Oz Show. So he and Melman Oz, and as you know, I was just on The Oz Show. And there was Mike in the audience, you know, cheering me on. So here's the guy that told me to start all over again. And now here I am with Patrick Kennedy on The Oz Show. And Oz is holding up the book. And there's, you know, kind of my mentor to the book, Dr. Mike Roizen, in the audience cheering me on. So we had some amazing stories in there, but between Ann's dad and Dr. Roizen, those are two of my favorite stories.
So based upon the success of the book so far, do you think you might write another book?
Well, certainly Ann and I are talking about that. You know, we created a company called Everyone Matters, and this is our first book on something that we think matters, healthcare. And our idea is we're going to create a series around something called Trusted Voices, of which Trusted Healers becomes the first of that. Based on our experience of over 70 years of doing the business of the people, thinking about education, extensions on healthcare, government, et cetera, we're thinking about that. And many people have approached us. So first-time authors, we've learned a lot. And it's been very challenging for anybody that's thought about writing a book. You know, you definitely have to check your ego at the door. Although the first time somebody wrote a bad review, I stayed up for 3 nights. I wanted to figure out who the person was, and I wanted to go track them down, you know, and convince them that their review was totally wrong. But nonetheless, we've learned a lot. And I'll tell you this, JD, if Ann and I think that we can make a difference, you know, that we created this company called Everyone Matters because when we go out and speak and do the things that we did, we would end our talks. I would end speeches where I would look out to the audience and I would say to people, "Why do we do what we do?" And for the longest time, people would give me the stare of the Wisconsin dairy cow. Like, you know, what is he's going to say next, you know? And I would say, you know, I would tell people when I say, "Why do we do what we do?" And then I would tell them, "Because everyone matters." And it wasn't too long after I started doing that, JD, that when I would conclude a talk or being in front of a large group or even a small group, whether it was at IBM or outside of IBM, no longer was I answering the question, "Why do we do what we do?" But the people were answering the question, "Why do we do what we do?" And they would say, "Because everyone matters." And just think about what the world looks like. Just think about what the communities look like if we all thought that way, that everybody counts, that everyone matters, and we help everyone do the best they possibly can. And it starts with giving them access to care and it encourages them to be engaged. And we redefine their empowerment to make a contribution in productivity in society. I think that's a good thing to do. Ann and I are honored to try and bring that forward in a social impact kind of organization like Everyone Matters. And if another book works within our quest, our desire, our dream to make a difference, then yes, we'll write another book.
And you know, maybe tell us what your view of Everyone Matters is in terms of beyond the book, are there other things, other projects you're involved with?
Well, you know, we started this company a couple of years ago in 2017, and we really did design it as a social impact enterprise. And as Dan said, it was really around our experience in citizen-based services, health, and education. We early on did some pro bono work to study the issues with immigration. We spent time in Texas, and we were at safe houses. We visited a variety of locations to understand the issues that the immigrants at that time were facing and how we should think about serving our interests as a country and serving the needs of people. So we did that and learned a lot. I can't say that we had tremendous movement in that conversation, but we learned a lot and supported some work with a number of organizations. We have been very much involved with higher education and the definition with a number of universities on what does education of the future look like and how should they be thinking about the design of their university, their reach and access to students, the continuation of learning as they become professionals and beyond. So we're in those kinds of conversations, bringing our experience, and now thinking about how we can translate that into action for our company.
Outstanding. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, JD.
Thanks, JD.
Thanks for joining us on Executive Perspective, Behind the Business. Visit our website at www.washingtonexec.com for more content and episodes.